is CBSI on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Sackett versus Environmental Protection Agency. There is Sackett 1, there is Sackett 2. And to choose between them and to understand why this was argued before the Supreme Court in 2022, and we can expect a decision at best in 2023, despite the fact that it's been for most of the century in doubt, I welcome Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, writing at Defining Ideas. He teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago. Richard, reading this very carefully as an amateur, I'm struck by how similar it is to what Dickens made of the Chancery Court once upon a time in the 19th century. Once you enter into this tangle of courts and appeals and lengthy discussion with amici curiae filed by distinguished bodies around the country, you are before the court forever. You are at the court's mercy. This is now 15 years and counting to decide something that looks commonsensically straightforward. We've discussed this before. The Sacketts have a piece of land in Idaho. They want to build a house. It is nearby Priest Lake. Nearby, I'm using that word indistinctly because there are critical terms here. At some point, the Army Corps of Engineers and other voices observe that the Sacketts may be likely in violation of the EPA's Clean Water Act. Maybe, likely. However, all of this turns on the definition of a few commonplace words that now are in play, even in 2022, 2023. The word wetlands, what is wetlands? The word navigable, what does that mean? And the word adjacent. Good evening to you, Professor.
Good. It's nice to be here. And yes, there's a lot of open questions about this case. And it is not atypical to see cases that involve land use disputes drag on for well over a decade, because virtually everything that is done by a higher court then goes back to an administrative agency. And there are no rules that are explicitly involved. And so what they do is they require lower courts and administrators to give intensive fact-specific inquiries about a particular set of issues without explaining very clearly why it is all this stuff turns out to be relevant. So what you're pointing out here is, in fact, a very common problem in the land use and in the environmental law area.
We begin with, in your Defining Ideas piece, to know of the 1975 case, Natural Resources Defense Council versus Callaway. This is where we get the idea of what waters need to be protected or are protected under the writ of the EPA. It reads, the phrase that's important here, the waters of the United States, including the territorial seas, that matter is what's in play. And then we come to whether the traditional tests of navigability, Now, again, as an amateur from the outside, I would say that Priest Lake, Idaho is navigable water. However, the land that the Sacketts are seeking to build a house on in 2007 is not next to the lake. It's not even close. It's on the other side of a road. So help me understand how the Sacketts are now in danger of polluting the lake from the other side of the road.
Well, I mean, this is a bit of linguistic wizardry, and you mentioned this Callaway case, and it's extremely important because it's a very unusual decision. If you go back and you start reading it, what you discover is a one-page opinion by a judge, and it reads like a peace treaty. The NRDC is a very prominent environmental group. Callaway was the Secretary of the Army. They have a runaway, an ordinary dispute of one thing or another, and they then agree to a settlement which says that when we talk about the navigable waters or the waters of the United States, we mean everything that the Commerce Clause can reach. Now, this is a straight collusive settlement as far as I'm concerned. There's absolutely no legal authority that supports it. If you're trying to figure out what a navigable body of water is, what a water of the United States is, they're telling you this covers the territorial seas. The territorial seas is the absolute antithesis of a wetland. And so the clear argument has to be that what we do is we have to protect the navigable waters. charters. They talk about dredge and fill permits. Now, these have been given from the time immemorial. What happens is there's a river. It tends to silt over in certain cases. There's some kind of natural disaster that influences. There are various kinds of pollutants that come in, and somebody wants to change it. You just don't let people come in and start digging up a river where it can interfere with navigation, with recreation, with water consumption and quality and everything else. You require that they get a permit. And the reason you require them to get a permit is that the probability that they will do some mischief inside the river, if they're not correct, is one. It's going to be there. And you then have to make a lot of very difficult trade-offs about exactly how much of a repair you want to do. It's going to have this, that, or the other kind of effect, for example, on water that's available for fish to do salmon runs and stuff like that. And it's a perfectly sensible system. And basically, under those cases, the battle should be, and often is, what kind of condition do you attach to the particular permit? What kind of inspections you put on it, but at least you know what the exercise is. Now, in some sense, the waters in a wetland will be connected to the waters in a river. But if it's a wetland, it means that you can't sail any boat there at all. It's the antithesis of a natural, of a waterway. And the question is, how is what goes on there going to influence what goes on in the river? And what the scientists all want to tell you, and what was said, for example, by several of the judges, Kajani Jackson was one of the most obvious, said, well, this is an integrated system. And indeed, it is an integrated system, because waters from the navigable waters tend to drip into the wetlands, and they come back again and so forth, and they can carry stuff one way or another. But the question you're not trying to figure out is whether they're integrated. The question you're trying to figure out is whether the stuff that takes place in the wetlands or even further removed from the wetland is going to have any adverse effect on the way in which the natural waters of the United States move. And so if somebody, for example, wanted to stage a huge operation, they put thousands and thousands of tons of land inside the wetland, and you could show pretty clearly that a lot of this stuff is going to seep into the natural water, well, something has to be done. The key point here is you don't want to use the permitting system for these things unless they have massive proportions. What you want to do is to let the government watch this. And the moment it starts to see that there's some kind of difficulty, it brings an ordinary common law action for a nuisance, saying you're about to pollute the waters of the United States. It's imminent. It's a very serious threat. We're entitled to enjoin you and to get damages. So that's the model. Then you take the Sacketts. And they're sitting up there 300 feet away on a piece of dry land, which is an ordinary building plot like everybody else's. And ask yourself, if you change the regime, saying that given the distance, you have to prove that there is going to be some actual harm inside the navigable body of the water, unlike the dredge and fill cases where you know it's there, nobody in the history of the world would ever be able to go to the SAC and say, we're going to enjoin you because we think that you're going to create some kind of a danger. And somebody says, are you kidding? At this particular point, you've shown that there's some water there, but you haven't shown that it leaked out. And if it leaked out, I haven't shown that it's gone any further than the next door neighbor, or that it's caused any kind of harm. What you would require the government to do is to say, you really think this is so? Tell me why it's different from all the lots on the other side. And what the SAC could say is, well, we'll tell you what we'll do. We'll put some dye, get some neutral party to do this into our particular land, and then see whether or not that emerges in the lake down below. The chances of that happening are basically zero. And so you would say, not only is there no imminent threat of harm, there's no threat of harm at all. Go home. So why are the scientists all of a sudden coming forward and saying, if that's the way you would treat this before the statutes came, you're doing a better job under the statute when you've immobilized a plot of land now for 15 years, denied people the liberty to build there, denied the state the real estate taxes, spend a fortune on bringing these particular kind of lawsuits to present what? To prevent what? Absolutely nothing. I mean, this case is so far off the map.
I want to explore, however. I've raised a high bar, Bleak House. All right.
Yeah, well, that's what we're in.
United States versus Riverside Bayview Homes, 1985. Mm-hmm. Empowering the Army Corps of Engineers to, as you say, read its grant of power to the maximum. In 2008, they ordered the Sacketts to restore the site to its original condition because the determination was they were polluting Priest Lake. However, they also imposed a fine of $37,500 per day. When Sacket 1 reached the Supreme Court in 2012, what the Supreme Court did was not decide the meaning of adjacent or navigable or wetlands. All it said was the $37,500 is voided and come back to us. 10 years later, we're coming back on Sackett 2. Have I got that chronology correct?
Unfortunately, you do. I mean, you think about this. Here you're talking about a fine. Fines are supposed to be roughly proportionate to anticipated evil. If you're saying you're going to give that kind of a fine for a day, you're saying, in effect, that within 2 days, the potential harm to the public waters exceed the total fair market value of the plot of land that you're talking with. They did find water on the land, but it's interesting where they found it. The Sacketts dug, they left a bunch of holes, and then rainwater sits there and it fills it in. It's a bit of a mess, as construction sites already are. And they now decide that this part of the land that has been removed and not fixed up again has become a wetland. Instantaneous wetland. Now, this may be science to some people. To me, it is simple madness. Well, they do this, and now they say we can fine you this particular amount. Mind you, they made no showing whatsoever of any potential connection between what goes on the Sackett plot of land and what goes on in Priest Lake. They didn't even try to do that. What they tried to do is to argue that they fell within the jurisdictional confines of the expanded mandate of the Clean Water Act, and that's what they get away with. Look, I mean, I have to say, this term science is something that we all ought to respect and revere. But every time a political body uses the term in connection with a particular dispute, you basically have to put your hand on your wallet, because they're not talking about science at all. They're using their claim for science to basically misconstrue the basic situation and pretend that there's a serious scientific issue that's there when there isn't one. To give you another example, Joe Biden, when he started to talk about how he was going to stop COVID, said all the science says that we could stop this thing by wearing masks outside for 100 days. That's not science. It's your fantasy that something like that could work. And yet people do this. So what happens is it's cheap talk. And if you ask the particular scientist not to show you that waterways are integrated in some way with other waterlands of one kind or another, or wetland, show me where it's coming from and how it's moving. Don't make a claim of integrated stuff based upon first principles of human nature or of scientific truth. What you want to do is to show the movement of water back and forth. We've been dealing with nuisances from private lands into public waters for at least 500 years. And nobody has ever thought that this is the appropriate place on which to draw the line. So the real question is, what set of remedies do you give against an unanticipated remote harm? And the first rule of good law is that when you have something which is a one in a billion probability, you don't do anything. You wait until the probabilities increase. You don't have to wait until the pollution starts to take place. You want to have some sign that it's imminent. That's the test that has always been used. And under these circumstances, there's no reason to deviate it. So what's going on in this case is they give a jurisdictional ploy, misreading the statute. And then what they do is they say that all potential harms are of equal probability and equal importance. And both of those moves are completely illegitimate.
Let's bring it up to date, Professor. We'll come to 2022 when we return, and the question of how a West Virginia versus EPA case of 2022 sits next to, adjacent to, the Sackett case. Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.